the Seagram's block of Oshawa, Ontario. I'm an idol.
Don't be scared, homie.
Okay, first of all,
the world is smiling at you. The wrestling business is smiling at you. And don't you frown back on it.
Surprise, surprise, motherfucker. The king is back.
The man to power, the man with the power. Too sweet to be sour.
Dylan Bowker.
All right, on this episode of Bouts Talking Bouts, happy to have on UFC Super Fight Champion, the inaugural titleist, which you could consider the lineal UFC heavyweight title. I know I certainly do. First King of Pancrase, also 1998 King of the Ring winner, one of the more well-regarded intercontinental champions in history. I've got the world's most dangerous man, Ken Shamrock. How's it going, Ken?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you, especially ahead of quite a tour you're going on here, kind of going through my neck of the woods in Ontario and just traveling through Canada and all that. An evening with Ken Shamrock, stories, Q&A, meet and greet. How much are you excited for this? I mean, you seem like you very much enjoy storytelling and imparting wisdom. So what are your thoughts on this tour coming up here?
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I had a great career. The fans supported me through that career. And even the ones that didn't really support me, they still bought tickets to come watch the event, which is supporting it. So I just want them all to know that I appreciate it. And the way I do that is by going out and being able to have these cozy conversations with people, being able to get into these nice events and these nice places to be able to sit and talk with them, have them ask questions to me, and me being able to answer for them. And so for me, it's a joy to be able to go out and really meet all the people who really helped support me over the years. And so I'm excited about it.
Absolutely. And you wrote Inside the Lion's Den, which is a book I own and I've read several times. And I mean, it seems like the next logical step to take it to a live and in-person Q&A sort of thing. So is that kind of your thought process and just the next step in wanting to relay your stories?
Yeah, it is. You know, I mean, these people, the fans themselves are very important in my life. And I really treat them as a part of the family, as a part of the success. And so I have an opportunity to really go there and be able to talk with them and tell them stories and there get to ask questions that maybe they've been wanting to ask for a very long time. So yeah, it's a great opportunity for me to be able to go out and give back.
Yeah, and you have quite the history with Canada. I mean, you had that big pay-per-view main event there with the Hearts. I mean, in your house, 16 Canadian Stampede, and you had some run-ins with Bret Hart and Owen there. And that kind of leads me to talking about that match that took place in the Hart family dungeon there. I mean, everyone talks about that Lion's Den match with Steve Blackman, which is a very entertaining, you know, sort of gimmick match that they had set up there. But I really appreciated the Hart family dungeon match and how you guys worked that out. I'm just wondering, like, was there a certain, like, degree of challenge that came to piecing together a match like that? I mean, it must have been fun because it's, like, taking place in this unconventional framework. So how did that all go down from your memory?
Yeah, you know, I had to got to be able to jump in there with Owen and Dan Severn as the special guest referee. And we really got to challenge ourselves because there are no ropes. There's no rolling outside the ring. There's no fans to be able to play off of. And so it was a challenging match to put together. And I really enjoyed working with Owen and being able to try to piece that together so it came out and looked right. So we really got stiff with one another. I know Owen got a couple lumps on his head and a couple lumps on his back, and I know myself got a few scratches and cuts. So it was fun. We really enjoyed putting that match together.
Absolutely, and you've had some real rough goes in the ring there with guys like Vader and a bunch of other bruisers, guys who are known to be kind of stiff in the ring. Were there certain guys who had like a real aversion to that, like more snug kind of style that you recall?
Well, I know Vader was one of them, and I tell you what, that was a real honor and also a real advantage for me to be able to have my very first wrestling match with Vader, because I was able to be able to go ahead and let go a little bit just as he was because of his style. Mm-hmm. So we really worked off of one another and really enjoyed being able to have that match and be able to not have to worry about whether or not he was going to leave the ring and start crying about he got hit too hard. I didn't have to worry about that with him.
Yeah, for sure. And you've had quite the interesting run. I mean, going back and forth with professional wrestling and then also going towards mixed martial arts there. And I mean, you had a gimmick prior to eventually becoming Ken Shamrock. I mean, you were working as Vince Torelli for a little bit there. I mean, back in the South Atlantic Pro Wrestling territory there in Charlotte. So when did you get to a point of endeavoring to be like, you know, Ken Shamrock instead of like, oh, I'm going to go out there and have like a bit of a gimmick, be Vince Torelli? Like, when did you get to the idea of realizing the persona was you yourself?
Well, I started out as Vince Torelli before I started into the MMA, my MMA career over in Japan.
Yeah.
Vince Torelli was really early on. So I developed that character because that's what I was told. Like, you couldn't come in with your name and you couldn't be you, which I didn't really have an identity. So I came in as Vince Torelli, Mr. Wrestling, because I had a really good wrestling background and, you know, I was into Tough Mans and all that stuff. So I went in there, started working as Vince Torelli, started putting together a pretty good resume. I had some great matches, carried some straps with North Atlantic and South Atlantic Pro Wrestling. So I was really putting together some good things. And then Dean Malenko came around and actually showed me a videotape of this thing called the UWF. And I remember watching it, and they were kicking, they were punching, and then they would kick each other down and work submissions. And I was like, I never saw that. And I was like, man, I want to do that. And Dean looked at me and said, no, that's stiff. That's like, they go at it. And I was like, I don't care. I want to do that. And he says, well, I can hook you up. My dad is one of the promoters for Japan. Sammy Saranaka is the guy that brings people over there, and he's over at my dad's gym. And I said, you know, introduce me. And so I flew over and did a tryout there in Miami and pretty much dominated everybody. I think it was 6 weeks later, I was over in Japan, and I was doing a tryout over there. And I got my butt whooped, but got an opportunity to talk with Sammy, talk with the Japanese promotion, and they really liked what they saw. And I think it was probably 3-4 months later, I was fighting in front of 16,000 people, 17,000 people.
And what was it like being part of UWF back then? Because, I mean, that really, you know, hit a hot streak for a little while and then obviously led itself into promotions like Pancrase and just really got across that overlap between professional wrestling and mixed martial arts that much further. So what was it like with that whole evolution, eventually getting yourself into Pancrase, which was a promotion that was built on the crux of what happens if pro wrestling rules get applied to a shoot competition kind of idea?
Yeah, when we did that, I was in, UWF and then, Fujiwara Gumi, when the company broke up, Fujiwara Gumi, and that got a little bit softer than the UWF. But myself and Funaki and Suzuki and a few other guys were wanting to kind of branch out and do something more real. And so that's when we separated from Fujiwara Gumi. I went with Funaki and Suzuki to form this new company called Pancrase. And, we debuted our first match, and they were all shoot matches. They were all for real. And so that was the start of what we're now seeing today with UFC and all these other things. It started there because that was the very first shoot competition.
Yeah, I mean, Minoru Suzuki and Masakatsu Funaki playing a big role in just the training for all of that. And I kind of wanted to tie this into the Hoist Gracie conversation. This is a bit of like a long-winded question in a way, but I mean, the feud you had with Hoist Gracie, there seemed to be a lot of conversation around history and just legacy that came out of that. But it seems like to me it goes beyond just the localized legacies of yourself and Hoist Gracie, in as far as there's always seemed to be this feud between, you know, Japanese informed catch wrestling and also various Brazilian submission disciplines. I mean, that goes back to Gracie versus Kimura. There's a lot of history in that. And I mean, coming out of that initial UFC tournament, there was a lot of, you know, talk around Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and it got to this, you know, transcendent sort of level. So did you process it on that level of frustration whereby maybe you thought, oh, if I had have, you know, got that big W there, then catch wrestling would be like the go-to martial arts discipline?
No, I think my frustration doesn't come from any discipline. Mine comes from the idea that it seemed like every time I got into a match with Hoist, there was always a new rule put in or there was things taken away to gain advantage over me. You know, in the very first UFC that we went to, it was no holds barred, no rules, anything goes. That's what everybody was told. We get to this rules meeting, and all of a sudden they're saying that, you know, Zane Frazier can't wear his shin guards and that I can't wear my wrestling shoes and that other people can't wear this and wear that. But yet, because they said that they were used as weapons, that this is no holds barred, not supposed to wear any gear. And yet Hoist was wearing his gi. A lot of us didn't understand what was going on at the time of what they were saying. Because we didn't know I didn't know he was going to walk in with a gi on. And if he did, I didn't realize that that was a weapon. I just thought he wore it, you know, because I didn't know a whole lot about what they did. And so then I get choked with the gi. I'm slipping all over the mat because I don't have my shoes on. And yet I felt like they pulled one over on me. And so I go into the next fight thinking, okay, well, I'll get even now. And, I go into that fight and they put a time limit in. First time ever. There was no other time limit before that. And if you watch the fight, I beat him up pretty good in that they end up carrying him out of the ring because he was so exhausted. And that was only 36 minutes. I was fresh. I trained for a 3-hour fight because it was no rules, no time limit, and I was going to wear him out. And so I couldn't change my plan the day before the fight. I had to keep going with what I had already trained for. And so there was another obstacle. Then we go into the last fight and I'm thinking, okay, now everything's going to be right. And he knees me in the nuts on purpose, because if you're a trained professional fighter, which we are, you don't go low like that. Not like that when the guy's just standing right there in front of you. And so that was another way out for him. And so feels like it's empty. Like we never got a chance to really do it right.
Yeah, and I can imagine how that would be frustrating. I imagine there was a similar amount of frustration with the Sakuraba versus Mezger fight, where they agreed beforehand that there wasn't going to be that sort of bonus round, and it seemed like Mezger was going to win, but then they tried to, you know, keep the fight going for Sakuraba there, and then obviously you blew up, and then it kind of got into this like disqualification sort of territory. So are you happier with the sport nowadays, and as far as it seems more like regimented and there's more rules in place to prevent certain chicanery like that from going down?
Well, I mean, I'm glad that, you know, some sort of, you know, regulation to it. But at the same time, it seems like now that there's regulations to it, now people can't be themselves. Like there's no characters anymore. There's nobody like Conor McGregor, obviously. You like that type of thing, but, you know, he went over the line. Like he doesn't – just being able to keep guys being able to have their characters, be their personalities, but – you know, play within the rules. Don't go beyond the line of that. And so it seems like we've got no balance with this, what's happening now. It's like we do need characters. We do need people to be flamboyant. We do need stories. And we need people to be, you know, themselves. But at the same time, we can't have the Conor McGregor type personalities with the throwing chairs through the window or you know, dollies through the window. You know, there's got to be boundaries and stuff, but you still have to have characters and storylines.
Yeah, I mean, because it seems like it's very, like, homogenized nowadays with, like, the uniform Reebok style. It seems like they're very much trying to discourage, like, certain character development as far as guys getting, like, their most authentic version of themselves out there, and that's kind of a bummer.
It is, because that's, I believe, people come to watch a story. They come to watch characters. They don't come just to watch a fight, because there's fights everywhere. I mean, what makes your fight different? Why do people want to come watch your fight? So there's got to be history or storylines or characters that are involved that make people want to watch a fight.
Yeah, there absolutely has to be that narrative. And a compelling narrative was when you were going into that Kimbo Slice fight for Bellator there. I mean, you were hours away from your family. You were living in an RV that didn't have running water and, you know, culminated in this whole fight here. And I mean, it seemed like a recurring theme in a couple of your last fights there. It was you were chasing this certain, you know, feeling. You're getting away from your entitlements is how I believe you put it in one of your other interviews. Do you feel almost indebted to the prior struggles you've gone through in your life, being that you were, you know, this young kid living in cars and you got knifed at one point and all these things? It's because it seemed like you were trying to chase that kind of, like, I guess, feral animal kind of a mentality almost. So do you feel indebted to those experiences in your life, being that it gave you this instinctual foundation to compete at a high level?
I don't feel indebted, but I do. I feel like I was definitely chasing it because I wanted that edge back. I wanted to have that edge back. And it just felt like the more civilized I got with my family and my wife and started being in these boundaries and stuff, all of a sudden, you know, I didn't have that edge that I used to have, where I would just, you know, I'd run through a wall 10 times until I got through it. I didn't have that mentality. So that's what I was chasing in those last two fights, is to get back to that.
Yeah, for sure. I get it on that end, but I kind of wanted to talk about the mentality for bringing people into Lion's Den. Cause I interviewed Tanya Evinger and she was saying that at one point she was booked for like a shoot fight within the gym, like to be part of the fold there. And then the opponent she was set up with ended up no showing, and then she, you know, ended up eventually being a fixture within the team. So I'm kind of wondering if stuff like that was common practice at Lion's Den, and if there was like a certain process of, you know, proving yourself to, you know, become part of the team.
Yeah, to be a part of the team, the Lion's Den team, wasn't about how good you were as a fighter. It was about what you had inside. You know, you could be good, but what we were looking for is people that would run through a wall, like I was talking about earlier, you know, run through a wall 10 times till I got through it. That's the mentality we were looking for. And on the same thing though, we were looking for people that had character and that had respect, for the process. So the tryouts that we did would definitely, start a nation, you know, 8-hour days of training with guys screaming and yelling in your face, telling you, you know, good, get out of here, you don't belong here. And yet you're still pushing through 500 squats, 500 push-ups, you know, and running 3 miles and doing squats and being able, at the end of all of that training, you go in and then you have to fight somebody, and you know you're not strong enough to be able to fight anybody, and yet you're getting your butt kicked, but you got to keep getting up. It isn't about passing it with flying colors. It's about keep going on. And that's why I was able to develop, you know, within the UFC, I think I developed 6 world champions in a short amount of time. And it was because of that type of regimen that we would find guys that had the mentality and guys that had the respect.
Yeah, and you certainly had a stable of just killers there. But we were briefly talking about Minoru Suzuki earlier in the conversation, and I know you're, you know, very much set on getting to WWE, and that would be a great thing for you, like wanting to wrestle guys like Kurt Angle and Brock Lesnar. But, I mean, Minoru Suzuki is still very much a relevant wrestler, and he's been doing some great things over in New Japan Pro Wrestling. And I think there's a lot of narrative backing to a potential feud with Minoru Suzuki. So I'm wondering if it's, for you, WWE or bust, or if you would also, you know, really entertain going to New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Yeah, no, like I said, I would do the pro wrestling if it made sense. And Minoru Suzuki makes sense, definitely. So does Sakuraba, if he does pro wrestling. But Sakuraba do, because of the screw job I got when I fought him the last time.
Yeah, because I've seen prior interviews where you were saying you felt like his gloves were loaded. Is that correct? And then obviously the fight was stopped prematurely from your perspective as well.
Oh, big time. It was really bad. It was really bad. I didn't even get hit. I just slipped through the ropes where they had walked. And then when he kind of clipped me from behind the head, and when he did, I felt like, and if you watch him fight, you'll see his arms. They're hanging. So I believe he had them gloves that had sand inside those gloves or something. Something heavy in those gloves. And it's been something that's been said, in the locker room many times about, some of the sneaky things that they did over there. And so that was one of them. And when he did hit me, that's when I was talking to them in the corner, telling him, check the gloves. And of course they didn't check the gloves.
Yeah, that's such a wild situation. And we've talked about your journeys in Japan. I haven't really touched on Pride Fighting Championship as of yet. I mean, there's so much that people talk about nowadays with the Yakuza involvement with Pride Fighting Championships and like people getting bags of money as, you know, means of payment for competing. Did you notice anything, I guess, suspect or maybe like fugazi in your times competing for Pride Fighting Championship?
I only fought for them once, three times. And
yeah.
So my interactions in there were very brief. I didn't get too involved in it because I had already known the reputation. So I did one contract there and we did my fights and then I left.
You just weren't interested in competing for them long term or anything like that based on what you were talking about with them kind of being a little bit shady in their business dealings.
Yeah, even the short time I was there, there was a lot of things they did that I was very unhappy with. And so I just kind of moved on from that.
anything you care to elaborate on, or just kind of like the stuff we were talking about with like loaded gloves and things like that?
Yeah, there was a lot of different things they did. Well, just with Don Fry, they allowed him to have oxygen in his corner. Then they allowed him to tape his ankles like casts. And when in between the rounds, you know, I saw him getting oxygen and I was like, hey, what are they doing? I mean, he was getting pure oxygen between rounds and it was like I was cheating. And so otherwise Don Fry, cause like I said, I didn't think he was going to make it, for three rounds at all. I didn't think he was going to make it out of the first round, and he was definitely exhausted in the first round. And I felt like coming out the second round, I would definitely handle him. And then I saw him giving him oxygen and I was like, that's like someone just giving somebody recovery.
That's insane. I never even really, yeah.
Yeah. Then he taped his ankles in casts. So when I tried to turn his heels over, I couldn't literally get them all, even though I broke them. It's still, if there's no tape there, then I break him and he can't walk.
Yeah, and that was such a central part of your game, just the knee bars and ankle locks and stuff like that, to allow something of that nature. I mean, it just directly goes against your game and your offensive initiative there.
Yeah, it was disappointing, like I said. But, that wasn't the only thing. It was a lot of other things that happened, too. But when it's on something that large and that big, you just, you basically say your piece and make your statement and you move on, because it's in Japan, So in the States, you can do a whole lot more. But in Japan, you're basically a foreigner, and you got no leg to stand on.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, in your fight with Kazuyuki Fujita there, I kind of wanted to touch on that briefly, because it seemed like a terrifying episode for you. You thought you were having a heart attack in the ring. It turned out you were having very severe heart palpitations after the fact. I'm wondering, was that the most terrifying moment you've ever had in competition?
Yeah, it was. Wasn't a terrifying moment. It was more of a moment where I just lost all control. I mean, I literally was just seeing white spots and I'm basically blind and I can't breathe. Those two things right there, because my heart was doing whatever it was doing. So I wasn't able to get the oxygen. So therefore I was starting to see spots, white spots. And so my heart, I couldn't get enough air. So it really messed me up.
Yeah, no, that must have been terrifying in the moment. Like, how quickly after the fact, like when doctors looked at you, did you realize that things were, going to be A-okay? Like, how long was that sort of period?
I think it was 20 minutes or so before I actually got my vision back. I felt cloudy and like smoky, like it was smoke everywhere, which wasn't. It was clear. And I just felt really, out of whack. And I remember raving to my corner. I knew my corner was on my right. And so when I was backed into the corner, I literally had him out. I mean, I just backed him into the corner with me. And of course he wasn't doing anything to me, and I'm waving somewhere near my corner, cause I can't really see that well. Hey, and then they couldn't even understand what I was saying. And then when they finally did realize what I was saying, they were like bewildered for a minute. Like, what? You're winning. You're killing them. And it's like, throw it. Cause I was literally getting ready to pass out.
Yeah. Cause like when I was watching that fight, I was watching that in real time and I was initially kind of confused as to what was going on. But then when the details emerged, obviously it's understandable. I think any normal human being would try to, get things wrapped up at that point.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't see. And like I said, that was probably the scariest part, is not being able to see.
Oh,
the
for
oxygen
sure.
And stuff like that, getting ready to pass out. So therefore he could have hit me however he wanted to.
Oh, yeah, you'd be a sitting duck. Exactly. It would be a foolish thing to, kind of keep going on if you can't see there. But I've been touching on the fact that you've been involved in certain worked environments and certain shoot environments as well throughout your career. And you had a bit of a situation with Kazuo Takahashi in that he tried to break the script on you and then led to you, knocking him out with a soccer kick pretty early on there. I'm wondering if there were any other occurrences in your career whereby you were involved in some sort of work and someone tried to turn it into a shoot and you had to smack him around a little bit.
No, not really. The only time that ever anything like that was Suzuki. And that was, I can't talk about it because there's a lot of contractual things there. So I may have mentioned one time about it and got in trouble for it, so I got to kind of watch what I say.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. So, I mean, yeah, just a further thing to add to the narrative between yourself and Minoru Suzuki. And I mean, I guess going back to that briefly, you've been reaching out a few times to WWE, and there seems to have been like a little back and forth there. Have you reached out to New Japan Pro Wrestling at all? Because like you said, I mean, a feud with a guy like Suzuki would make sense. So has there been any kind of dialogue with New Japan? Because it seems like for Gaijin performers, this is one of the better times in history as well.
No, nobody's contacted me. It doesn't make sense though, right? It seemed like that'd be a great opportunity.
Yeah, especially your kind of style. I feel like it would lend itself really well to the entire thing there. But I kind of wanted to switch gears real quick and talk about that Steve Aoki video that I, you know, saw you involved in there. How did that all come together? Like, did they reach out to you and then things got going on with that? Like, how did you end up in a Steve Aoki music video?
Well, it just came, we had a friend that we've been training with. We worked in an actual fight league together. And so when this came up, he felt like, hey, you know what? These guys really helped us out. Let me give him a call and pay it back. So, we did. He paid it back. He got us involved. It was a great opportunity. Really liked, Aoki. He's a good guy, down to earth, man. Good person. So that was a fun time for us.
Is it cool to be like a sort of pop culture figure in that sense too, in that you got brought in and you were like a reference point in that video? And also, I was watching a rap battle the other day with two guys named Big K and Danny Myers, with one of the battlers, Big K, comparing himself to you. He was comparing himself to Ken Shamrock, and then his opponent he was comparing to Dan Severn. So I'm kind of wondering what your thoughts are in that sense on being like a pop culture figure that people reference in these kind of situations.
No, it's fun. It's enjoyable. And you know, it's one of those things where you're honored that people are using you or your name or your person on a video game, or like you just said, where they're acting like you are in a different types of situations. It's an honor. I mean, it makes you feel good.
Yeah, no, it's really cool, and it's good to see the legacy keep going. And really, I could talk to you for hours on end just knowing the kind of legacy you have and just what you've done in mixed martial arts and pro wrestling. But I also want to be respectful of your time. I know you have a busy schedule of interviews and everything like that. So is there anything you want to add as a parting thought as we're wrapping up here?
No, just, man, I really appreciate the support over the years with the fans and stuff. I look forward to coming down to Canada and being able to talk to everybody and do a Q&A, ask questions, and I'll answer them. So, hey, look forward to being there. And in fact, I leave tomorrow morning to get on a plane and come down there, so I'll be there soon.
Yeah, and we're looking forward to having you. World's Most Dangerous Man, happy to have him on Bouts Talking Bouts. Really do appreciate the insights, Ken. Thank you for your time, and enjoy the rest of your night, man.
Hey, thank you. God bless.